on this Friday, February 16th. Should be partly sunny and seasonal for the morning hours. Sunny for the afternoon, a high of 28. Right now it is 28 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am excited for this opportunity to reconnect with a talented writer, biographer by the name of J. Randy Tarabarelli. He has written very, very interesting books about very, very interesting people. Some of his books in the past have included Call Her Miss Ross, the unauthorized biography of Diana Ross, books about Madonna, the Hiltons, Frank Sinatra, Beyonce. He has written several books about the Kennedy family in one way or another, and his latest book is called Jackie, Janet, and Lee. And many people will know exactly who this book is about just by hearing those three first names. We are talking about Jackie Kennedy Onassis, and we are talking about her sister, Lee Radziwill, and we're talking about their mother, Janet, Janet Auchincloss, and the intriguing lives which they led, and their interesting, intriguing relationship with one another that was very, very close, yet sometimes very, very difficult. The full title of the book is Jackie, Janet, and Lee, The Secret Lives of Janet Auchincloss and Her Daughters, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis and Lee Radziwill. It is a thoroughly researched book published by St. Martin's Press. And J. Randy Tarabarelli, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thank you for that introduction. I really appreciate it.
The subtitle brings up a very interesting point, the secret lives of these three women. And I wonder if you could say a word about the challenge of finding out the truth about these so-called secret lives, which in a sense are secret no more, but in terms of trying to bring to the public a lot of events and exchanges and so on that happen behind closed doors in the heart of a family's privacy, and particularly when we're talking about anybody related in any way whatsoever with the Kennedy family, I should think that becomes an even steeper challenge for you as the author.
It is a big challenge in many ways. You know, luckily, this is my third Kennedy-related book, and so I've been down this road before a number of times over the last 25 years, and during the course of that kind of research, you cultivate sources who trust you, and then when the book comes out in which they're involved, you know, they are happy with it, and then they cooperate with the next one, and then they tell their friends and family members that they can, you know, trust me. And so over a period of years, you begin to develop a network of sources that becomes invaluable to telling a story that's never been told before. And in the case of this book, having written about Jackie in two previous books, the challenge was to look at her through a completely different lens. The other books I've written about Jackie, of course, they were relating to her life as a Kennedy. And this book really doesn't have a lot to do with her life as a Kennedy. I wanted to place her in a context of who she was before she got to the Kennedys and how her mother influenced and shaped her character and her personality and everything that we know and love about Jackie before Jackie was even a Kennedy. Her mom was informing her and shaping her And so this book is really about it, the other side of the family. You know, a lot of people never think about Jackie as even having another side of the family, but she certainly did. She had a sister, Lee Radziwill, main character in this book. She also had a half-brother, Jamie Auchincloss. She and Jamie have the same mom, Janet. She had a half-sister, Janet Jr., again, with the same mom, Janet. And this is a whole family dynamic that the public doesn't know anything about. Even to this day, I have talked to many people about this book who are completely astonished to know that Jackie even had a half-brother and half-sister named Jamie and Janet.
Hmm. I agree with you. This is something, it's amazing that more of us haven't asked more questions about this. You know, even those of us who, for one reason or another, are interested in the Kennedy family or interested in John and Jackie Kennedy, have not necessarily just taken the time. It's like the Kennedys themselves absorbed so much of our attention, so much of the spotlight, that this other side to Jacqueline Kennedy has just, in a sense, escaped our notice, at least to large measure. You said that part of the process in putting a book like this together is to cultivate trust with all these people that you have talked to. That is, that they would trust you enough to be open and share sometimes very sensitive stories about themselves and the principles of this book. What about the reverse? How do you go about determining who is trustworthy as a source?
It's so interesting. You know, that's a really good question, and I have to tell you, it's pretty rarely asked of me, and I love addressing it because I have researchers. We have a team of people that have been working with me since 1989, and we have what we call a sort of a source management company, a division in which we manage our sources. And we spend a lot of time doing background checks. I have private investigators who actually will do a background check on source to find out, you know, what their history is and who they are. And also, you know, we interview our sources 10, 15 times per book. I mean, we drive them crazy. We really do. Because, you know, my books take a number of years to research. And if I interview a source 1 year, and then a year and a half later go back to that source, and the stories begin to change, then that tells me something. You know, if I go back to that source and the stories get better, that's not good. People usually don't remember more with the passing of time. You know, so you have to be very careful with sources and finding out which ones have axes to grind, which ones have hidden agendas, and which ones are just pure and want to just tell a factual story about their experience with someone without any vendetta attached to it. So you're right. It's a really good question because it's something that I deal with all the time that people really don't know anything about, and that is, you know, source management. And of the maybe 150 to 200 people who are interviewed per book, about 30 of them don't make the grade in the final analysis. You know, about 30 of them I have suspicions about, and sometimes those suspicions might be unfounded, but if I can't completely trust a person, then that person can't be a part of my book.
Hmm. Well, and I think that says a lot about the quality of books that you create versus other biographies that are not put together with a similar sort of care and with a similar sort of devotion to trying to tell the truth.
Thank you.
I'm speaking with J. Randy Tarabarelli, and we're talking about his latest book, which is called Jackie, Janet, and Lee, The Secret Lives of Janet Auchincloss and Her Daughters, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis and Lee Radziwill. I think one of the things that is quite intriguing about this particular family is that they are a wealthy family, but not, in a sense, sort of an obscenely wealthy family. And it is a family that is complicated in some intriguing ways, and yet not a family racked with terrible controversies or terrible shame, although there are certain things about this family that are certainly a source of some embarrassment. But I just find it in a strange sort of way. It's a very unique family, and yet they feel a little bit ordinary in the sense that maybe in a way they are not the Kennedys in that respect. Do you think that's a fair characterization?
I do. I think that's a greatly fair characterization, and that's one of the reasons why I loved writing about this family. It's because they're so relatable, you know, that their problems were interpersonal more than they were dramatic on the historical stage. Unlike the Kennedys, where you have these big moments, the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, the assassination of JFK, the assassination of Bobby, Chappaquiddick, I mean, major, you know, major moments that are historically relevant. This family, Jackie's side of the family, had personal interactions that were explosive, that no one knew about, but just the same are interesting, and I love telling those kinds of stories that people can truly relate to, you know, because I think at the end of the day, you know, when people like Jackie and her sister Lee and her mom Janet go to bed and they're with their own thoughts and their eyes are closed, you know, they were thinking very much the same kinds of things that we all are thinking about our siblings or our parents.
Right.
And that's to me, that kind of universal theme. Look, I've done the other, believe me, and I've enjoyed it, you know, and I'm actually working on another Kennedy book right now called The Kennedys, The Next Generation, and we saw one of those Kennedys recently, you know, with in the Democratic response to Donald Trump's State of the Union, and that's Joe Kennedy III, and the Kennedys are still making an impact on our culture, and I appreciate that, and I'm writing about it still, but what I love about this particular book is that it's much more of a personal sort of intimate story of mothers and daughters and sisters. And you know what, to be honest with you, that's the real drama right there.
Absolutely.
I mean,
right.
Know, and moms and sisters.
Right.
It doesn't get better than that in terms of storytelling.
Right. The love and rivalry between sisters, the protectiveness of a mother that sometimes goes too far, and sometimes the wrenching choices that people find themselves forced to make. Yes, I think a lot of us, even if we're not a Kennedy or an Onassis or a Bouvier or a Radziwill, will recognize aspects of our own lives and our own relationships and what unfolds here. You tell us very early in the book, in the chapter called The Beginning, that Jackie and Lee Bouvier could not have been more different from each other, even from the start. What would be a couple of the most distinctive ways in which, even as youngsters, there was a very distinct difference between these two sisters, for however devoted they were to one another for at least most of their lives?
Well, you know, Jackie is about 4 years older, and she was always, from the start, more outgoing and more charismatic. You know, Jamie, Jackie's half-brother, told me that she always sort of had this, you know, air of success and of distinction about her from a very, very early age. And Lee was just more of an ordinary girl. And I don't say that in a pejorative way. I just say that you know, when you're a kid, usually kids are just kids. But every now and then you end up with a really precocious child who is just very different than all the other children, you know, in the neighborhood. And that was Jackie. You know, Jackie just, she was very adult. She communicated with adults in a different way than a normal child did. And this just sort of left Lee feeling for much of her childhood inferior to her much more sort of elegant and popular sister.
Hmm.
And I think it's worth noting also that when the girls were very young, Janet, who did not approve of any competition between them, would often lecture them and tell them, you know, that I don't approve of you competing. I want you to be there for each other, to be completely supportive of each other in everything that you do. You will only have each other in this lifetime. And after she would give that lesson to the two girls, she would take Jackie by the hand and then go off shopping or to lunch or wherever, and she would leave Lee behind. And one of the reasons, perhaps, is because Jackie was 4 years older and had more in common with her mom. But that said, I think it created in Lee at a very early age the sense of competition between her and her sister that was inadvertently fostered by their own mother. And it stuck with Lee throughout Lee's entire life.
Hmm. I was really struck by something that is said, again, early in the book, in a chapter called A Sad Kind of Love. This is in the chapter where we hear about Lee actually marrying at the age of 19 in kind of a desperate bid to, first of all, escape the protectiveness of her mother and to just gain some distinct happiness of her own. It's a marriage that does not last very long. But in this chapter, you quote someone named Chauncey Parker III, who was the son of, I don't remember now, but somebody connected to the family. Maybe the son of Hugh Auchincloss, the son of one of his business partners, I think.
Yes, exactly.
Right. So, and he knew Lee from a very young age and said of her, she had a douceur about her. Douceur is a French word that implies more than gentleness, something stronger than just sweetness. She had a sense of wonderment, a lilt in her voice, and a wonderful smile. She was someone you really just wanted to take in your arms and hug. She had a delicious aura. And again, this is talking about not Jackie, but Lee. But it's as though Lee herself did not understand this about herself and did not appreciate her own special beauty distinct from Jackie's.
Wow. Thank you for that analysis, because that is so on the nose. I mean, that is exactly it. You know, I personally, I fell in love with Lee in this book. I knew nothing about Lee prior to this book. I mean, I'd met her and, you know, talked to her, but I just really knew nothing about her. And she really is, in so many ways, really the most fascinating of the three women, and that she, you know, she had everything that Jackie had, and in many cases a little bit more, but yet Jackie had the charmed life, and Lee had to work through her entire life for everything that she ever was able to attain. Nothing was ever handed to Lee Radziwill. And she was much more idealistic and romantic in the way that she looked at life. And I think that her first marriage to Michael Canfield really tells a good story. Michael Canfield didn't have any money, and he, some people even thought he was gay, and there was a lot of confusion about that in the family. But Lee, just her heart went out to him, and they sort of had this same kind of whimsical, you know, pathos about them, and that was what brought them together. And I think that that relationship said a lot about Lee, you know, whereas Janet had lectured the girls early on, do you really want to know what the secret of happily ever after is? And they said, yes, mommy, what is it? And she said, money and power. And Jackie, according to Janet, got that right away. But Lee thought that was appalling, you know. And Janet said, you know, poor Lee was so shocked by that, but this is a lesson that Janet felt Lee needed to learn. And it wasn't until Lee was in her mid-60s, as you'll find reading the book, that she actually married somebody with money. Prior to that, she was going for something else in her relationships, and it wasn't about money and power.
Hmm. We're speaking with J. Randy Tarabarelli. His book is Jackie, Janet, and Lee, The Secret Lives of Janet Auchincloss and Her Daughters, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis and Lee Radziwill. We should mention that one of the most distinctive figures in this book is Aristotle Onassis. And, of course, one of the most intriguing things, as if he wasn't intriguing enough on his own, is the fact that he has romantic dalliances with both Jackie and Lee, first with Lee, eventually with Jackie, and of course eventually Aristotle Onassis and Jacqueline Kennedy are married. And one of the things that I found quite remarkable in your book is the portrait you paint of this man, who often is talked about now in the most unflattering of terms, or with only attention given to the things that made him, you know, maybe a fairly grotesque and repulsive sort of figure, kind of a symbol of arrogance and obscene extravagance. But there were other things about him, even apart from being so incredibly wealthy, that made him actually quite charismatic and obviously a figure of at least some sort of allure to both Lee and Jackie. Can you say a word about that?
Well, thank you for pointing that out, because I think it's really very easy when you're writing about these sort of historical people to make them cartoon characters. And I think that has been the case with Onassis. People have approached him as if he wasn't even a human being. And he actually was a very fascinating person, you know, who made Lee feel like she was special. You know, Lee had up until that point, always felt that she paled in comparison to Jackie. And Onassis said, no, that is not the case. You know, if anything, you're far more interesting than Jackie. You're different. You have a lot to offer. You know, and I find him fascinating. This is the third time I've written about him, and so I know a lot of Onassis's family members, and a lot of people have, you know, expressed to me stories about Onassis that show me that he was a much more in-depth and complicated person. Now, this isn't to say that he didn't have his mercenary side. Of course he did. And this isn't to say that he was a prince of princes, you know, because he really wasn't. He was a flawed person. But he was not a bad person. And I hope that when people read this book, they'll understand that, you know, he was not just a simple man to understand, that he was a very complicated but very interesting person.
Right. At one point you write, Onassis had an uncanny understanding of human nature and knew how to appeal to people no matter their stations. He could engage in a lively and entertaining conversation with anyone and make that person feel as if he or she was the most important person in his life. That's an important gift, of course, for people to have. I appreciate the fact that you reveal as much as you do about the trauma and heartbreak that Jacqueline Kennedy experienced in the wake of her husband's assassination. And we leave it to our listeners to explore that in your book, but I think you do a remarkable job of telling that still largely untold story with such discernment and also sensitivity, for as much as you do reveal. And we also certainly come to understand how the assassination of Bobby drove Jacqueline Kennedy to a very special kind of level of fear. And it made that marriage to Aristotle Onassis, in a sense, a compelling necessity. And it also put Jacqueline and Lee at odds with one another. It's a fascinating story. If you don't mind, I really want to leap ahead, because I think one of the other really intriguing stories I don't think ever really thoroughly told before is the final years of Janet, and especially of Jackie's desperate attempts to keep her mother safe in her own home, with a very overpowering fear that she was being mistreated by the man she was living with. Can you just sketch the situation for us? I think a lot of people will appreciate this difficult scenario.
Well, this is a story that has never been told before, and to be able to tell a story about Jackie that people don't know is, you know, it's quite astonishing these days, you know, because so much has been reported and we think we know it all, but this is a story that even I didn't know until I researched this book. Janet Auchincloss, Jackie's mom, married a man named Bingham Morris when Janet was in her 70s, and she was on the at the onset of Alzheimer's when she married him, and Alzheimer's began to take over her life during her marriage to this man, her third husband, and she told Jackie during the course of this that this man was abusing her, possibly sexually, possibly physically. Jackie couldn't be sure because of the fact that Janet kept changing her story because of her illness. And as you can imagine, this was very difficult for Jackie and also for Lee to not be able to get to the bottom of it because the Alzheimer's disease was sort of standing in the way of clarity. And Jackie fought very vigorously to get this man out of the house. And she managed to evict him a couple of times, and then he would keep coming back. And Janet kept fighting Jackie every time Bingham was gone because she wanted him there, and then when he was there, she wanted him gone. And this went on for a couple of years in Jackie's life while she was an editor at Doubleday, which is a period of time that I first knew Jackie and first met her. And it's interesting that she was able to sort of compartmentalize all this, and no one knew this was going on in her life. I certainly didn't. And it was very difficult, and I think anybody can relate to who has had an elderly parent can relate to this sort of horror of wanting to protect this person from somebody and not really being able to do so. And that was what Jackie faced in Janet's latter years.
Right. It's one of those cases where even when you are Jackie Kennedy Onassis, one of the most famous women in the world, that doesn't mean there aren't those sorts of issues and challenges that are beyond your own power to wipe away. it really makes her human in a way that isn't always the case when we read about or see someone so incredibly famous and distinctive. I appreciate that and much more about this fascinating book, again called Jackie, Janet, and Lee, The Secret Lives of Janet Auchincloss and Her Daughters, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis and Lee Rodswell, published by St. Martin's Press. J. Randy Tarabarelli, thank you so much for writing this fascinating book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. What a pleasure.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It's nice to talk to you again, and I'll talk to you soon, I'm sure.
The time is 8:37 on the Friday Morning Show, and part two of the program out of the Morning Show archives is coming up in just a moment. If there is anything that people in modern America, throughout the world for that matter, tend to take entirely for granted, it is the notion of instant photography, of pointing your camera, your iPhone at something, pressing a button, and voila, there is the image forever captured. Once upon a time, and those of us who are old enough vividly remember this, you had a camera with film in it, and when that film was exhausted, you wound it up, you opened up your camera, you tucked it into an envelope, and you mailed it off. And you waited for those pictures to be developed and to be returned in the mail. And that was a whole different world. It feels like a different planet we're describing. And one of the geniuses who helped change the whole notion of photography is a man by the name of Edwin Land. And he helped develop the famous Polaroid camera and a brand new technology which utterly transformed people's understanding of photography and their expectations. But with the development of that spectacular new Polaroid camera came some real trouble in the form of various competitors encroaching on those important discoveries. And hence the stuff of a fascinating new book called A Triumph of Genius, Edwin Land, Polaroid, and the Kodak Patent War, in which we hear about the struggle for Edwin Land and the Polaroid company to fend off competition from Polaroid, from Kodak, with technology which they believed encroached upon their patents. And the author of this book is someone who was involved in that groundbreaking case, Ron Feirstein. He was a lawyer with the firm of Fish and Neve, representing Polaroid in that battle with Eastman Kodak. And Ron Feirstein, as a matter of fact, worked very closely with two of the most important witnesses on behalf of Polaroid, Dr. Edwin Land himself, as well as Howard Rogers. And so he has a very intimate understanding of this entire dispute and its significance. Since then, he has gone on to a career of representing a number of people in the recording and theater industries, and but has taken time out of that busy, interesting life to write this fascinating book, again called A Triumph of Genius, Edwin Land, Polaroid, and the Kodak Patent War. And Ronald Feirstein, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg. How are you today?
Just fine. I am so happy to talk with you. A couple of times in the last year or so, for no particular reason, I have thought about the Polaroid camera. I so vividly remember our well-to-do relatives from Milwaukee coming to visit us in our little town in northeast Iowa, and my Uncle Carl having with him one of these spectacular Polaroid cameras, and at least the one he had, this would have been in the mid-60s, was, you know, now in my mind's eye, a huge contraption. But this notion of the picture, you pull it off, you peel this thing away, and you wait, and just within seconds, you actually see this image. It was like an astonishing miracle.
There's a great quote from Arthur Clarke, the famous science fiction writer, that says, he said back when, that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And I think that's exactly what you're touching on, Greg. This was a radical departure from the way photography had been done for more than 100 years, where you could hold the photograph in your hand just moments after pressing the shutter.
It was just extraordinary. And again, in some ways you feel like you were present when you saw your first automobile or something like that, when all you'd known before that was horse and buggy or stagecoaches or something.
Exactly.
I don't know, but it felt, in a sense, almost as revolutionary.
Well, you know, an interesting aspect of it, in your introduction, you talked about, you know, how people can take pictures with digital cameras these days or their phones, for example. And, of course, that's true. But the big difference between that kind of instant photography, if you will, and the kind that Polaroid did was that with Polaroid, you actually held a print in your hand. And with the digital camera, of course, you have to show the photograph on the screen and otherwise. But it's not quite the same thing.
No, not exact. And I think it's also one of those instances in which now, of course, a Polaroid camera, it might as well be a butter churn in terms of its utter irrelevancy to our modern life. And yet, at some point in time, this was a spectacular innovation. And I think one of the interesting things about your book is that you help us understand the science behind this innovation beyond the really interesting sort of legal battles which ensued. Talk for a moment, first of all, about Edwin Land himself. I wish we had longer to talk because he is an extraordinarily fascinating figure who apparently from very early in his life was tremendously fascinated with light. Tell us more about that.
Well, he, as a young camper in a summer camp, a counselor demonstrated to the kids the phenomenon of polarization. Polarization, very simply, is the ability of some materials to be able to take the glare out of bright light. The only material that people knew about in those days, which were the 20s, were big pieces of crystal, big pieces of rock that could take the glare out of bright light. And Land, as a young man, and some of his friends, they immediately thought of all kinds of applications for a more practical material, everything from sunglasses to camera filters to taking the glare out of automobile headlights. And so he committed himself to that. It became an obsession of his. He started experiments in high school. He went off to Harvard, but dropped out in his first year to pursue experiments to try and come up with a practical polarizer. And then at the age of 19 years old, he solved the problem. He found a way to create a very thin piece of plastic that had microscopic crystals embedded in it that could take the glare out of bright light. And from that, he was able to start his company, which became Polaroid. And your sunglasses of today, your LED screens, your polarizing filters on your cameras, so many, many applications use that technology that Edwin Land developed at the age of 19 back in the 20s.
Hmm. The prologue of your book talks about a moment in 1943. Describe to our listeners the event that you describe in your prologue.
Well, what happened was Land had built a $200 million company based upon this polarizer technology. A lot of the growth came from World War II, where they produced all kinds of devices for the military. But at the end of the war, as the war was winding down, he became concerned about the future of his company because he was never able to sell the polarizer to Detroit as a great idea. And so he thought, well, this is going to be a limited market for this invention. I need something else to apply my energies to and the energies of my company. And he was on vacation with his daughter. They were taking a walk in New Mexico, enjoying the light, snapping away, taking photographs. And when they were done and they were walking to the drugstore where he had to drop off the film to get it developed, his daughter started tugging on his pants and going, "Daddy, Daddy, I don't want to wait. I want to see the photographs now." And, you know, a lot of fathers would just dismiss a young kid complaining about that, but not Edwin Land. Edwin Land, it really sparked something in his mind, and he immediately set out to come up with a photography system, a revolutionary one, that would provide a photograph within moments after snapping the shutter.
Hmm. Tell us more about what was required to achieve this technological breakthrough, and just how radical a reshaping of the whole process was this? I mean, was he taking technology that already existed and just sort of shaping it and altering its process, or was this completely different from the kind of photography that had been done before?
Well, you know, Land used to say that all scientists and all inventors' work rests on the shoulders of those who went before them. And so I think that that is absolutely true, and it was true in this case. This technology is called diffusion transfer, and I don't want to get too technical for your audience, but basically you have a material in the negative, which then transfers to a positive to create a picture based upon how that negative has been exposed. And it's called diffusion transfer in black and white. It's a silver colloid material that transfers in color. It's a dye. In fact, the same three-color dyes that form the color pictures in your computer printer, cyan, yellow, and magenta. And Land started, there had been back into the 19th century some work in diffusion transfer, very simple diffusion transfer processes where a negative would transfer an image onto a piece of glass, or very rudimentary things. And Land started with that technology. But to take that technology to the level where you would have a sharp photograph within a minute was quite a lot of work and quite an undertaking. And he and his team were able to accomplish that in 4 years. So 1947, he was able to demonstrate for the first time the first one-step photographic system. It took sepia photographs. And in 1948, Polaroid put out the first commercial system, which also took sepia photographs. And later, they put out black and white film. And in 1963, they were able to introduce color film. But all of those were peel-apart systems. You know, when Land first conceived of this, he thought of a photograph that would just come out of the camera and develop in your hand. But that wasn't quite possible, and it took a lot of steps to get to that. So the early ones, as you mentioned before, had to be timed and then peeled apart, and then you'd have to cover the print with some kind of chemical to stabilize it, and if you wanted it to lay flat, you'd have to mount it on a piece of cardboard. It wasn't until 1972 that Polaroid put out a system where that really reflected Land's original dream, which was to have a photograph come out of the camera and just develop in your hands with no further action taken by the photographer. And that was called the SX-70, and that was truly revolutionary.
Right. That's even a more amazing development. Well, of course, this is the kind of spectacular breakthrough that had a company like Kodak, of course, really spooked. So tell us what Kodak ended up developing, which Polaroid regarded, it would seem quite rightly, as an encroachment on their own patents.
There are really two themes in my book. One is the story of Edwin Land, who's just the most amazing inventor, third on the list of U.S. inventors behind Thomas Edison, that no one's ever heard of, and I just think his story needs to be told. But the other main story in my book is the relationship between Polaroid and Kodak over 60 years and how it went from mentor-protege to arch-enemies. It really is a story of almost operatic dimension. Polaroid would not have succeeded without Kodak's help. Kodak was instrumental at every step of the way in the early days. Kodak was the first customer for Land's polarizing material back in 1934. They bought the equivalent of $100,000 of that thin plastic that they turned into camera filters. When Land decided to start those experiments we talked about in photography, who did he turn to for the materials? His friends at Kodak. They gave him paper and chemicals and all kinds of things to work with, even though they had no idea what he was doing. And later, when he came up with the final product, he realized that his company couldn't manufacture the negative, so he engaged Kodak to manufacture the negatives for Polaroid film. And in fact, Kodak manufactured the negatives for every Polaroid film from the very beginning in the 40s well into the 1960s. And by the mid-1960s, Polaroid was Kodak's second largest corporate customer, second only to the cigarette manufacturers for whom Kodak made those small white plastic tubes they turned into cigarette filters. So these two companies had a long and mutually beneficial relationship, and were very close. Everything changed, though, in 1968 when Land showed the prototype of what was to become SX-70 to his friends at Kodak. For the first time, Kodak looked at that and said, wow, this might be the thing that challenges our domination of amateur photography. Because up to that point, when instant photography was peel apart, Kodak really looked at it as a curiosity, as a niche, you know, and they were happy to be a supplier of the negative. But when they saw this picture that emerged from the camera and didn't require any other work and just developed in front of your eyes, they got nervous. And they said to Land at that point, listen, we'll help you with this new film like we did with the others, but only if you let us manufacture some and sell it in our own yellow boxes. Polaroid couldn't accept that. They didn't think they could compete. And so at that point, the two companies went their separate ways. Polaroid went off to learn how to manufacture its own negative. Kodak went off to figure out how to compete with Polaroid in this field. And it wasn't until 1976, 4 years after Polaroid put out SX-70, that Kodak came out with its own system. Up until that point, no one at Polaroid, including Dr. Land, knew what Kodak was going to come out with. You have to realize Kodak was the most formidable photographic research company on the planet, and so they were fully capable of leapfrogging Polaroid's technology and coming up with something radically better. But in fact, when they came out in 1976 with their system, it really was not radically better, and in fact, it incorporated several aspects of Polaroid's technology, and from that came probably the most important patent technology lawsuit of the 20th century.
And we only have a couple of minutes to talk about that process, but I wonder for the average layman, if you could just give a sense of what the nuts and bolts of such disputes tend to be. I mean, when one is working through whether or not, in fact, a company like Kodak has encroached upon the patent of a company like Polaroid, what specifics are examined and in what way to arrive at a determination?
Well, it's pretty simple. You know, a patent covers an invention. And our patent system says that if you invent something and you disclose it to the world by publishing it in a patent, you can have a monopoly in that invention for a limited period of time, which at the time was 17 years. After the 17 years, it becomes available for everybody to use. But you have your limited 17-year monopoly in your invention. So when someone uses your invention without your permission, you sue them for it's called infringing your patent because they're using your invention. So the first thing you have to prove is that they're indeed using your invention. So you can prove that by just comparing the product they put out with the invention disclosed in your patent, and you make that connection. The other main contention that people who are accused of infringement make is that the patent is no good in the first place. Because even though the patent office may give you a patent, it's not fully determinative forever. And someone can challenge that patent and say, no, that you patent office was wrong. They shouldn't have granted a patent because the invention disclosed isn't really an invention. Because there is a quantitative level that you have to reach in order to be entitled to an invention. It has to be new. It has to be unobvious to others who are skilled in your art and so on. So Kodak was said in some cases, we didn't use your invention, Polaroid. And in other cases, they said, well, Polaroid, the patent you're suing us on is invalid because it shouldn't have been issued in the first place because the invention disclosed really doesn't rise to the level that warrants a patent.
Hmm. I noticed in your biography that you work directly with two of Polaroid's main witnesses, Dr. Edwin Land and Howard Rogers, during what's called the discovery phase of the litigation process. What was that like for you?
Well, that was a tremendous experience. In fact, I worked with them both through the trial. I wrote the outline for Dr. Land's and Howard Rogers' testimony at the trial and worked with them through the entire process. And it was fascinating because they were both wonderful gentlemen, incredibly intelligent. Dr. Land was a bit imperious, and some people saw him as harsh and difficult. Many of his employees were scared to death of him, but really, if you got to know him and if he respected you, he was warm, and I will forever be grateful for the fact that he let me work with him and tolerated my efforts, if you will, to learn a technology that he knew about. He knew more about than anybody on the planet, and I was frantically trying to learn this technology and frame it for him in the context of the lawsuit issues. And I really appreciated the fact that he somehow found that, my help to be worthwhile and let me work with him. And at the end of the trial, he actually autographed one of his patents for me, and I have it framed and proudly hanging on my office wall.
The book, again, is called A Triumph of Genius, Edwin Land, Polaroid, and the Kodak Patent War, published by Ankerweich, and the author, Ronald Feirstein. Ronald Feirstein, congratulations on a really, really fascinating book. I appreciate the care with which it is written, and I'm so glad we got to talk about it today. Thank you so much.
Greg, thanks for having me.
And here's what we have scheduled for the morning show next week here on WGTD. On Monday, we'll be talking with F. Diane Barth about her latest book, which is called I Know How You Feel, The Joy and Heartbreak of Friendship in Women's Lives. On Tuesday, you'll hear the conversation I'm going to be recording with a superb concert pianist by the name of Simone Dienerstein. She is going to be playing a recital at Carthage College next Thursday night as part of Carthage's Piano Festival. I'm very excited to speak with this fine artist. Wednesday, we're going to catch up with the Bell Ensemble, a wonderful group of musicians in Racine under the direction of Nick Berudian. And Nick and Edson Melendez, one of the fine singers who is often part of Bell Ensemble performances, they together will be talking about the Bell Ensemble's upcoming performance of Giovanni Pergolesi's comic opera La Serva Padrona. This is a delightful comedy, and it was really a groundbreaking work at the time. It really paved the way for many of the comic operas that followed in its wake. But this particular opera is almost never done, and so it's a special treat to be able to experience this the following weekend, the last weekend in February. So we'll talk about that on Wednesday. On Thursday, Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College, who joins us once a month to talk about current events. I wanted to make certain that Dr. Sear joined us during the Olympic Games, of course, that are unfolding in Pyeongchang, South Korea. Dr. Sear is a great expert on the Korean Peninsula in both North and South Korea. So we'll get his thoughts on the Olympics and on the prominent place that the Kriyas, both North and South, have on the world stage right now. And on Friday, a week from today, Michael Finkel and his intriguing book, The Stranger in the Woods, The Extraordinary Story of the Last True Hermit. This tells the true story of Christopher Knight, a man who lived for